Part of the joy of engineering management, or probably just any other endeavor, is to try some things that you feel uncomfortable with and get a new experience, lessons, learning from that. I hope everybody finds some of that in wherever they work, and then kind of bring back their collective experience so that we can kind of collectively push the envelope in every direction possible.
Welcome to Developing Leadership, the podcast for engineering leaders where Iso Kent and Jason Werner share their lessons on the ins and outs of managing software teams. Today we're joined by Kosuke Kawaguchi, the creator of Jenkins and founder of Launchable, the intelligence platform layer helping teams ship high-quality software faster. Kosuke shared his lessons on building two very different engineering organizations from the ground up and pulled back the curtain on building tech companies in Japan, fighting uniformity, written cultures, and economic viability. As always, this episode comes with accompanying show notes with a deep dive into the main topics, mental models, and key moments from the episode. Find them at developingleadership.co and linked in the episode description.
Hi, everyone. We're back again with another episode of Developing Leadership. We have a very special guest with us today, which is Kosuke Kawaguchi, who is the creator of Jenkins, but now also, since the last couple of years, the founder of his second startup, Launchable. Kosuke, I'm really excited to have you with us. We had a really nice conversation before the podcast. I'd love for you to kind of share with our listeners a little bit about your background and how you got to become an engineering leader.
Yeah. So, I grew up in Tokyo. And then when I think I was maybe 20 something, I got this unexpected invitation from Sun Microsystems to come over to the Bay Area and work for them. So ever since then, I kind of, was in the US. And then some random turn of events took me to work on the software that you mentioned, Jenkins. I built a startup around it. And now this is my second startup, Launchable. I've been doing it for, I think, close to 2 years now.
Fantastic. And so throughout this journey of yours, I know that you built two very different engineering organizations, the one that you built at CloudBees and the one that you're building now. What are some of the main lessons that you learned when you got a second go around at building from scratch?
So the first one was really, because the project, open source project, existed first, I was hiring people from there. And back then I didn't realize, but it sort of create this certain self-selected kind of people, very uniform in certain way, very diverse in another way, like geographic locations. But because I didn't knew any better, I thought, okay, this engineering team is like this. Right? And then the second time around, well, I didn't have an open source project to pull people from. Early on, I tried to hire people the usual way through I didn't want to hire from my network because that means pulling people away from CloudBees. I wanted them to succeed. So I tried to hire the usual way, like recruiters in the Bay Area, etc. And I just couldn't find any good people at a reasonable price. Now we're talking past 2 years, so you know what I mean. And that's when I thought, okay, actually, I knew a pool of people who the rest of the tech community is not tapping into because it's invisible to them, because I have a strong affinity and relationship, and that's the engineering team over Japan. So I talked to my co-founder and said, look, we've been spending, half a year, 6 figure, not turning great candidates and closing pool half enough. So let me build the engineering team over there. I know the people. So that kind of turned into partly my passion project, turned into what I think are the really sensible decisions that I want to encourage other people. So that's why I wanted to, talk to you. Yeah.
That's super interesting. So currently the entire engineering team is based out of Japan?
Yeah. So I have one guy who is actually originally from Japan, living here. He's ex-Googler. And then so he acts as, together with me, kind of a bridge, because all the rest of the corporate functions is in here, most notably the sales and product management. But the entire engineering team is over there. In fact, they're pretty much all in Tokyo, where every action is. And then we use those key connections, a guy over here, to bridge those gaps.
So to me, it's fascinating. Do you end up finding yourself with two different cultures within the company?
Yeah, I guess. So the thing, I think I'm probably used to this idea of different cultures within the company. I mean, famously, the sales and the engineering have an entirely different culture, right? Sales kickoff, you're going to get together in Las Vegas, you're going to sing and dance, and let's hope that everybody comes back home all right. And then engineering, right? Okay, what's the cheapest way to have this meetup? Because we need to save company money. So I think there's already a different culture. So I just added in this new endeavor, I just added a different dimension. I did notice after building a team over there that, you know, this particular team that I built there feels very different from the engineering team that I built at CloudBees or the one in the Jenkins project. And I probably shouldn't overgeneralize, like, you know, every Japanese engineer is like this or that, but I'd like to think it's some of that is, you know, like tied to what I think of the typical culture and norm. Yeah, so in that sense, it's unique. And in some sense, I think those seeing those differences and understanding other people, it's kind of like a key joy in working in a new team, right? So I really appreciate that angle that I'm experiencing right now.
I'm curious, how often do you get over to Japan then, or someone else on the team, maybe product managers, get over to Japan? How do you make this work? And obviously, you know, ISO and I have done this ourselves in various different constructs. GitHub was distributed and remote, Heroku was distributed and remote, and then Canonical was very distributed and remote. And I lived in Australia when I was doing it, but it required a lot of travel. And I'm curious how you manage that.
So, you know, at CloudBees, we are used to, you know, periodically getting together for all sorts of reasons, like building the actual human relationship, kicking off some new things, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, right as we were planning this first get together of the company, this was actually we built engineering team, but COVID happened and then all the travel disappeared. So for the entire 2 years, we were not meeting in person at all. So that was not something I planned, but you know, like everybody else, we kind of survived. And then finally we had everybody came together, I think this May. So that was obviously a very happy moment for everybody. But
what's your perception of productivity during the COVID times versus the non-COVID times and when you could get together physically?
So I think we probably did need to lean more on the like written down kata of things, like basically like writing that, okay, this is how we work, like a more explicitly written down than my previous company at the similar stage. Yep. That was helpful. We also like created more sort of like a forced social opportunity. We have this thing called Rocket Fuel Day. Like every once a month, we do some crazy stuff. So those things did help. And so I think relying on those was helpful. The productivity, you know, I'm still talking about just one team. So I wasn't too worried about that. If anything, I felt comfortable with the quality of the people who I was able to hire.
Yeah. I mean, obviously it's in the zeitgeist now as conversation where people talk about hybrid, remote or in-person and all those sorts of things. And I think all of us have various different views on that. And I'm curious, given you've been running it, but you know, I largely kind of fall down on the side of the fence where hybrid and remote is something that is incredibly advantageous to people to use, but don't expect it to work exactly like you would if you were running a team that was in office. And that's where major failings tend to happen is people think, well, I would do this in the office, therefore it doesn't scale and doesn't work with remote. It's, well, no, it's different. It's opposite. You know, you got to do X, Y, Z more as opposed to A, B, C. I think when people are running engineering teams too, it's easier to do this remote because engineers tend to like being, you know, either in more quiet time and all that. And like they prefer written communications as opposed to like many meetings or water cooler and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Great.
I mean, if anything, come to think of it, I have never managed a local team. So, you know, probably I'm sure if somebody is more used to that mode of operations, this doing things in mode did feel foreign. And just because of that, that alone is maybe enough of a reason to dissuade them. At some, which is where I was before, there is a different dynamics where they did have an office and a large concentration of people, one in the West Coast and the other in the East Coast. Then there are like, you know, sprinkle of people remote, and that really created a challenge for these, you know, sprinkles. So that was something I was in some sense intentionally trying to avoid.
That model right there is actually the one I think is the least successful for the remote people. And the people who can manage that in the remote context are usually the super seniors, the people who are well embedded inside the company or just very senior themselves. But, you know, I've seen people try to do that with an office in San Francisco and an office in North Carolina, and then randomly hire an intern in Austin. I'm like, of course that person's going to have a really hard time being successful. Right. They don't even know how to work. They don't even know themselves yet, let alone, you know, working remote in a company they don't understand.
Yeah. So in some sense, I think these general lay of the company is probably not something most engineering leaders can control. You kind of got to play the hands you're dealt with. I'm saying, like, you know, if you are in this like a remote side of a company, or if you're building some new engineering work from scratch, I feel like the world has moved a little more in that favor, in part because of the pandemic, but also because, you know, like other services, like, you know, global, what is a professional employment organization, like people who make the payroll easier or stuff like that. So yeah, I feel like they, you know, that progress in that area for the, you know, 2 decades that I've been in this space.
Koske, you mentioned something about 3 or 4 minutes ago around the fact that you started seeing differences in the organization. You've now built an engineering org entirely in Japan versus the one that you previously built, which was global and remote. Could you double click a bit on that and dive into some of the differences that you've spotted?
Right. So at Klaviyo is where I built this initial set of people from like a talented open source project. And maybe it's because how the Jenkins project is structured, where basically everybody gets their own sandbox called plugin, and they get to basically dictate their own space. So like we almost socially encourage isolations of responsibility, and people have added in their own space to minimize the collaboration, if anything. That might feel counterproductive, but it actually works well, like if you build everything around that notion. So the people, they are like a really strong, like individually capable, and they can like move therefore forward. But they are like sometimes like less cognizant of like the team dynamics, behavior, sort of catching like what ball needs to be picked up in the context of the team. Now this team in Tokyo almost feels like a polar opposite. Like, you know, everybody comes in, like they're all, you know, have prior work experience, coming in pre-wired with that sort of eyeballs, not just looking at their own individual work, but like what needs to be done in the team. And so I was really astonished that, oh, okay, so these, you know, there are these other kind of engineers who exist, and they, you know, without me saying anything, they organize this like a monthly retrospect and figure out like how to make the team stronger. And like one guy points out the challenge that that other guy is having. And it's like, yeah, that never happened at Klaviyo. So I was really just awestruck. So those are the kind of key difference, I think.
Do you think, without, of course, overgeneralizing, but do you think there is a cultural component here? I mean, Japan is known for its team harmony. Do you think there's something that is here that falls within that?
Yeah, that I wonder about that. I'm assuming that's part of it. I think another part of it is maybe because, you know, unlike in the US where there's a lot of population centers, so there's some level of like distribution always going on. In Tokyo, in Japan, like everything basically is in Tokyo. So everybody like in the tech community is basically within like a, you know, like a, you know, 50 miles radius. Perhaps that created some like a closer tie within the group, or maybe because a larger part of their software tech ecosystem is actually system integration and vendor building the system. So they are the high, you know, a lot of attention there went into, you know, like forming a team in relatively short notice from the pool of people, delivering a project for the client, working with non-expert that is a business owner of the effort. And you know, that's not a standard mode of operation here, right? We are building, most of us are working with like ISVs and building the, you know, final product. So maybe that focus on created a lot of attention around teams working together, making the effort visible, that sort of thing.
Let's flip it around a little bit and say you can go back and go do CodeBees again. You've learned a lot of stuff. You built a team over, this is your second company, so obviously you've learned a bunch of stuff, but you built a team in Japan, and maybe you've changed your mind on a couple of different things. Are there anything that you would want to go do different when you're redoing CodeBees, or maybe generalize it out and say preconceived notions you had before that you would want to, you know, correct this time around?
Yeah. So I think the one thing that I became more aware is there's always some uniformity or like a lack of diversity in some aspects. And almost by definition, when you're lacking it, you can't see that it exists. Like you tend not to seek that out. And instead, you tend to be happy with the like angle of diversity that you already have. So in case of like a Klaviyo, it's like I was very happy that I'm attracting people from around the world. Mm-hmm. And they do bring different experience and the mode of work in general, you know, the way they carry themselves, and loved it. But in retrospect, like all of them are, well, pretty much all of them in the beginning are a male. And like I mentioned, they are more geared toward the hard coding skills. software engineering skills and less about the team, you know, team soft skills. And then when we interview people based on the people you already have, and when they are the one that's deciding who comes in and who is not, they tend to self-select themselves. So, you know, it became difficult. It kind of self-created this organization of these people where different kind of people would have a harder time thriving. That's something I think I'd probably do differently, if that makes sense. I don't know.
It does. And what that generalizes out to, too, is that you have to be intentional, I think, in a lot of cases. Because what you said is also true, which is, I see this a lot in the States in particular, which is people say, hey, they want diversity. And what they mean by that is either gender or demographic diversity. But the point being that you had one version of one, you weren't intentional about another. You had to be intentional about this. It's the flip side of that too, is you could literally have a 50-50 woman to man ratio inside your office, but they could all be within a 2-block radius of each other.
Right.
Well, you're happy on one dimension, but you're failing on another. You got to be intentional about those as well.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly. So I felt, okay, like, you know, engineering in Japan for most people is probably entirely your hurdles. Maybe outside the Ruby inventor, you probably don't know anybody. So there is a, you know, one diversity axis that you could exploit.
And so for you right now, like you said, there's very few, you know, Silicon Valley based companies whose entire team from startup is in Japan. What are some of the advantages that it's given you? And what are some of the parts that you say, okay, there it builds us some struggles, or I expect issues to come up over time?
Yeah. So from business perspective, I think it's primarily like the, you know, the value per cost, right? The people there are, because it's like a blue ocean, like no recruiting effort, almost no recruiting effort from the US tech companies are done over there. So you have a lot of people, like talents that's available cheap, and it helps that the yen is getting cheaper. And two, because everybody there is very well connected. So when you start hiring a few people, the words of mouth are going to bring like other great people. And I always thought that initially you're building a new team, that's a surefire way of getting high quality people. They are also very eager to learn. I think there's I see this in San Francisco and New York, like almost every day, some meetup is happening. People are curious about what's going on elsewhere. They have they could just walk down the block to attend these things and get to know other friends. So they participate in these extra work activities that was at the level that I didn't see in the US. So those are, I think, all the good things that's going for them. Now, the key challenge, obviously, is the time zone and language. So, especially at Klaviz, like our first remote hire was in Europe. I think it's probably true in any, you know, most US companies, like you start here and then you grow over to Europe, and that covers the certain time zone band, and that makes it painful to add Asia, right? And language wise, the Japanese is quite far away from English. So that creates a challenge on its own. Fluency there is definitely worse than compared to, let's say, East European countries where, you know, people there speak like fluent English at the native speaking level. So I can't say the same thing. The way I bridge those two things is in kind of relying on writing culture. I mentioned already about maybe like a little bit more process heavy, like identifying like this is how we work more explicitly. Here's how you're going to write the engineering document. Here's how you plan this, like, you know, this month's effort. And so long as people know how to work and how other people behave, it makes it easier. And then that's not just about the Japanese team. I think it's true with any engineering team remote.
Interestingly, that's very similar to how open source tends to work too, open source, because people have been geographically dispersed throughout the world. Time zones have been a challenge, but two languages, like fluency, has always been a challenge. And so a lot of open source relies on, as we all know here, because we all have various degrees of open source experience, English as primary language, but heavy written docs. And some open source teams might actually get together individually once in a while, but for the most part, they try to do everything out and written in the open. And I think, again, like those are lessons that we could all learn as we're building out organizations that grow over time.
Yeah,
you know how open source has already done this for 25 years or so.
And another thing, this working mode, and speaking of open source, that is great at is tapping this part-time resource, right? Somebody not working for full-time. maybe they have an easier time if like more things are written and the more clear expectation of how they should behave. So that's something I think about. If you could tap like a part-time resources, then maybe it'll make it easier to access the other kind of talent.
You mentioned the language barrier. Do you think that because there is a language barrier, it has remained like a blue ocean? Because like you said, you mentioned Eastern Europe, which is, you know, most European tech companies and a lot of American tech companies will have talent remote these days in Eastern European countries without almost any barrier because English is commonly spoken.
Yeah. And then that's sort of why this is an important passion project for me, that, you know, it used to be that that country was, well, at one point, it wasn't a crazy idea to perceive that they might become like a most dominant nation in terms of GDP. I remember the book called Japan as number one. That was about 40 years ago. Now it's nothing like that, right? So it's the country is still, I think, maybe third or fourth in the GDP scale, but it's slowly declining. And then so people there, I feel like, you know, as a country to be viable, they need to develop a stronger tie to the rest of the world, is how I feel. And I do feel some like roots over there. So I wanted to do what I can help. And to me, that's building like a more bridge between those two sides of the ocean. And I do like removing any obstacle is like this, I think, is also economically viable endeavor. Because if it's just a social philanthropy, then I can't do it, right? But if this is an economically viable thing, then that's a different story. So I'm trying to pitch it like that. But you're right. I think that what comes the key obstacle there is the language. There's no doubt about it. And I don't see how to change that. I do see like more and more companies over there, like switching to English as an internal language of the company. There's more interest among people across the board to learn English and get better at it. And they see, especially the engineers, see more job opportunities overseas. So I feel like it's a challenge, but it's moving in a better direction.
Has the engineering, so, you know, Jason and I often talk about like the trends that we see in engineering, either, you know, on tooling, popularity of programming languages, you know, leadership practices, agile, dev, I mean, all of the ones that we've seen. I know I have a bit of experience with China, and you see that some of those things have gone in different directions because it's a country that has its own language, like ecosystem. Since right. Japan is so oriented on its own language, do you see any things that differ in terms of either how engineering works are run or tooling or anything that is like has gone its own way because it's built up its own bubble within its own language?
Yeah, I do feel like there is some different idiosyncrasies in the tech stack, especially in established businesses over there. Perhaps like more use of Ruby, understandably. But even here, I think, you know, if you go to federal space, you see a lot of Java projects and like, you know, older system integrators tend to use more proven stacks. That's like a decade or two older. That's different from what the Silicon Valley startups tend to do. So definitely that exists, which for me was less of a problem because, you know, before I built the team, I mean, I was the only one who was writing the code. So they could kind of take it and adapt it. I wonder if you're trying to build like one more team to establish product org, and then you're trying to hire people who come in day one and you know, productive is the stack. Actually, I'm curious, does that always work in the, come to think of it, even at Clavis, we don't always, it's kind of difficult to like, you know, people, I mean, how much value do people place on engineers with a prior experience in the tech stack you're currently using?
I can speak to that a little bit because I think that I think tech stack matters when you have less of a track record. Track record starts to matter more when you can point to it and you can say, here's how I would do that in this tech stack or whatever. And then also there's a difference between front-end engineers or application engineers versus infrastructure engineers, which tend to be more adaptable on new technologies and, you know, whatever it is. That said, it's still a burden, you know, to bring somebody in who doesn't have the tech stack experience. And I can speak to this locally. I live in Victoria, British Columbia in Canada, and it's the capital of the province of British Columbia. But the biggest employer here from a tech perspective is the local government, which uses decades old Java technology. So when people say, hey, we want to get a burgeoning startup scene here in Victoria, and we say we have all these programmers, I am quick to correct them. I say, no, we don't. we have legacy systems integrators who are employed by the federal government. We don't have a large pool of developers who are can be in a startup at the moment. They might be able to be in a startup a year from now if we employ them in a startup and we get them up to speed on, you know, the Pythons, the Rubies, the Nodes, the Elixirs, the Rusts, the whatevers of the world. But using Java XML, J2EE, blah, blah, blahs, and all that sort of stuff, they're not ready for a startup right now. So I think that there's always a gap. There's always a gap if someone's, you know, working for a federal government or something, some entity that looks that way from a legacy perspective and trying to jump over to a stack that looks like this. Mm. And it's easier to jump if the more senior someone is, but still has a very agile mind and they could work on backend systems. So, but it's a struggle.
A similar kind of difference that I realize is like, if they're used to work for a package software company, they're like a shipping is a rare event and like a big event that creates a different kind of mindset and culture from service company. And those things are, well, they really fundamentally affect the design choices you make. So
yeah. And it's funny you mentioned that because it's not directly, it's like, it's not Java that would lead you to believe that, but Java's ecosystem tends to be more packaged. Even these days still, it's like, hey, we're going to release that in 3 months and we're going to release the war and upgrade the systems and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, no, we don't work that way anymore. We release 200 times a day. And you know, this is the inventor of Jenkins and stuff like that. You know, a lot of people just don't think that way still. So again, this goes to that, my point about mindset, you know, when people have a different type of mindset, they can adapt and they can jump over, but if they don't, they're going to be stuck in their legacy worlds.
So Koska, one of the things that I'm still trying to wrap my head around and stay curious about is, you know, you're building an early stage startup. One of the main things that you want to do is have your early engineering team as product minded and as customer oriented as possible. Mm-hmm. But from what I know about your customer base and kind of language and geography, it's entirely different from a Japanese-speaking, Japanese-oriented engineering team. How are you bridging that gap, and how are you getting things back to the engineers to have them in that mindset, or do you not at all? Or I'm just curious to kind of, yeah, hear how you tackle that challenge.
Right. So I think interestingly, even at Klaviz, the engineers weren't, they didn't, or maybe the particular team that I had, they don't seem to be interested in like directly talking to customers. I felt like maybe it's because we are building the developer product. I think perhaps there's more assumption, which is incorrect, but more assumption that, hey, like I'm the target user of what I'm building. So I'm going to build what I need. So maybe there was a little bit of that. So anyhow, in this round, like the two things I intentionally really helped. One is the leadership trying to communicate the, you know, sales and product landscape more for the engineers. So we become like that broadcasting channel, and that, you know, works well with the written, together with the written culture. And two, we started recording these customer calls and sales calls. And then there is a software that like basically transcribe them. You can use a keyword search to, if a PM can use a keyword search to kind of zero in on the part of the conversations and prospects are having that's relevant to what they're working on. And I found that similarly useful for engineering. So I felt like some of the tech improvements that happened over a decade is really helping. And if anything, this team is far more eager to know how their stuff is getting used. And maybe going back to that, like a more cognizant of what's happening elsewhere. Yeah.
I know you're very passionate about Japan and wanting to develop Japan like as a tech scene. Is it possible for a foreigner, a non-Japanese speaker, to go to Japan and build a tech company or to build an engineering team in Japan? Like, is it something that's feasible today? Or is it something right now only accessible to people who have the ability to speak Japanese and maybe are from there or have a deep understanding of the culture and language?
Right. I think it's definitely possible. I mean, it's probably harder for somebody else with no ties to do it than, let's say, I was able to. So this was in some sense, it's a little bit of like a dealing, like, a, you know, play with the hands that you're dealt with for me. Like, what is my inherent edge? Maybe that was it. But I do think it's possible. And because this is my passion, I'm happy to help. I was talking to my fellow CEO and he had one of his engineers wanted to kind of moved to Japan because I guess he was fascinated with the culture anyhow. So that led to a conversation like that. And if a few more people build more bridges and, like, you know, if we talk about this more openly, like, you know, like we are doing right now, then it gets even more easier. So, you know, I'm looking for opportunity to help any way I can, really.
One of the things you said earlier that I definitely agree with, by the way, is whenever you have a passion project or something more socially minded, philanthropically minded, and I'm putting this in that same bucket, you want to help Japan, you want to think about this as a long-term mission of yours, the best way to get that done is to sell success. And to have success right. in the thing that you're doing. And I think that's something that's lost on people is they say, hey, I want to get this done. I'm going to use my company to get it done. But really, the best way to do that is to have that company be massively successful. And then there's a whole economic flywheel. But there's also, even more importantly, it stops the questions, which is if it could be done, it would have been done. And so you've got to answer that question. Good example of this, I think, is in Canada. People talk about Canada can't be a high-tech country. And then Shopify happened. And people no longer talk about that as Canada can't be a high-tech company. They talk about specific cities can't be high-tech cities anymore. And it's the natural evolution of that. But it was so critically important for Canada that Shopify be successful or something, somebody be successful. So, you know, I wish you luck in this because I think it's important. But I also want listeners to this to not be lost. Like, you can't push your social thing forward. It has to come be a success. That's how you're going to be able to do that.
Yeah, amen to that. And that's what I meant by economic viability. Like, you know, just because something is a good idea, you can't do it. It has to be actually a positive movement to the business. So in some sense, I recognize that onus is on me. But so far, I was able to justify it. And actually, on that point, there's another company who I modeled this after, which is called Treasure Data. And they, I think they were acquired by Arm a couple of years ago. I think more than $1 billion. So there you go. Their entire team is building, engineering team is in Japan. So I should probably get them to talk more about how they do things. So that's probably your next engineering leader you should talk to. Yeah.
Yes. So we can help here, right? So there's engineering leaders listening to this right now or watching it on YouTube or maybe founding engineering leaders, and they might be passionate about either moving to Japan or building something in Japan. Where do they start? Besides writing you.
Yeah, besides your careers page.
Yes. So please do write to me. I mean, I'm happy to help. And I'm thinking about, I wanted to create some place where I need to talk more about these things and collect the resources. And ideally, like, build a community of people who are trying this. It could be as simple as like a mailing list or some discussion forum like that. So I'm hoping to get that going at some point, but not yet.
And when someone sends you that email and says, hey, I'm looking to build an engineering team in Japan. I'm a startup founder. I have no idea where to start. What's the first thing that you would write them back?
I think I'm going to forward this like a PDF that the Japanese, Tokyo's government built about this program. And maybe make an intro. Well, I'll probably get on the phone and tell them my story. kind of go from there. So you need somebody, you need to be able to find some guys that will resonate with your company's mission. Become the first batch of engineers. So, they make a finding some influencer over there to that you could have interviewees and so things like that. I think it's helpful.
Since you're one of the very few people who has this as their passion, now we expect you to build a $10 billion company to put Japan even more on the map for its engineering orgs. I do really appreciate you talking with us about it because it's, to many of us, it's a black box, and you opened it up a little bit today and showed that it's possible. And one of the things that I love that you shared is that, you know, you found a team there that has this incredible team collaboration oriented mindset and that's helping you guys as an early stage company. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave our listeners as parting words as they think about this topic?
I think there's part of the joy of engineering management, or probably just any other endeavor, is like, you know, to try some things that you feel uncomfortable with and get a new experience, lessons, learning from that. And so, to me, like, one of that is this. But I hope everybody finds some of that in wherever they work, and then kind of bring back their collective experience so that we can kind of push collectively push the envelope in every direction possible. So yeah, that'd be my call for action for everyone. Push the envelope.
Fantastic. I appreciate that. Thank you so much, Kosuk. It's been a pleasure to have you on today. And we really look forward to seeing how the journey continues. There's a heavy burden on you now to put Japan on the map.
thank you.
Thank you for listening to Developing Leadership. Make sure you subscribe to follow us on our journey to more meaningful engineering leadership. If you have any challenges or topics you would like us to explore in an upcoming episode, tweet or DM us at devleadership_. To learn more about data-enabled engineering and how metrics can help your teams and improve your processes, go to athenian.com. See you in 2 weeks for another episode of Developing Leadership.